This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. Last week, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced that the Justice Department was suing Texas over voter ID and joining the court battle over redistricting in Texas. This is despite the recent Supreme Court ruling that defanged a critical part of the Voting Rights Act. Holder and the Obama administration was criticized by virtually every Republican office holder in Texas for the move, as they also defended the Texas voter ID law. Also part of the fight is gerrymandering in Texas, something that Democrats did routinely when they had political control of the state. And court battles similar to the one being waged now are what gave Republicans their first footholds in Texas. Joining me now to talk about that is Professor Gary Keith. He's the editor of the book Rotten Boroughs, Political Thickets, and Legislative Donnybrooks. Professor Keith also teaches political science at the University of the Incarnate Word. Professor Keith, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And we invite you, listeners, to join the conversation. Let us know what you think about the Voting Rights Act and what's happening with voter ID and gerrymandering in Texas. The number to call, 614-8980, 614-8980. So, Professor Keith, your book that you edit, you've written part of it and you're editor of it, Rotten Boroughs, Political Thickets, and Legislative Donnybrooks. Very colorful title. What are these things? What is a rotten borough?
A rotten borough was a district in England. As people moved off of the farms, the serfs got jobs in the industries in London, and you ended up with these places out there with very few people, lots of cows, but they kept their representation in the British Parliament. And so they were rotten in the sense that the people had moved away from them, and yet they still had representation. And so James Madison and others, as they were crafting the U.S. Constitution, wrote that they did not want rotten boroughs in the United States. What they wanted was equal representation. Political thickets is a phrase that comes out of a U.S. Supreme Court case in the 1940s where the Supreme Court said, we're not going to get involved in redistricting because it's just a political thicket. It's not a constitutional issue. You legislators and governors go battle it out. Well, legislative Donnybrooks then references those battles because we have these horrendous legislative battles now over redistricting.
And all of these items are coming to play in Texas, as you write about in the essays in the book. Before the redistricting battles that we're having today, very different but similar to the battles that we had in generations past. There was a long time where Texas, when the Democrats were in control, would do everything to resist having any redistricting at all.
Redistricting is never a friendly battle. What is redistricting about? It's about rearranging the seats of power. And if you're in a seat of power, why would you want to rearrange it? And so sure enough, in the early 20th century, all of the seats of power were in the hands of Democrats. Moreover, they were in the hands of rural Democrats. So you get layers of groups here involved in trying to get engaged in the political discourse. That's what this really is all about. Who has a viable, equal chance to have a voice in the political discourse? And so if you can protect your seats even as the people move away and you create rotten boroughs, you've got power individually, and yet equal representation has been damaged.
So that a person who lives in an urban area, their individual vote for a representative is actually less, means less than an individual who lives in a rural area when there are fewer of them, and they vote in a rep in Austin.
Well, that's the way it was in the early 20th century. It's kind of reversed now. And one of the reasons it reversed was that the political thicket that the Supreme Court referenced in Colgrove versus Green is no longer operable. The courts threw in the towel in the 1960s and said, we must enter because there are issues of constitutional equal representation at stake here. And so now population equality is not an issue so much because they demanded that every district have equal number of peoples in it. So now it's come down to, well, all right, how can we carve the lines in such a way that we have equal number of human bodies in the districts, but we can still maintain our power base?
When we talk about equal numbers of people in a district, I mean, there's no way to get an exact equal number of district per district. What they do is they do have a basement and a ceiling that they have to work within that to arrive at similar figures, but not exact.
The court has looked at it both for Congress and for the state legislature, and you're right, there are ceilings and floors, but for Congress it is very narrow. They have to be almost exactly the same. They give states a little more leeway because we are states, but for congressional seats, they have got to be very close, and they are as a result of that mandate from the court.
Well, you do hear about overpacking of, say, like urban districts.
But that, again, is an issue not of overpacking of numbers in, but of what kinds of voters are packed into one district and out of another, whether it's race, racial groups, ethnic groups, partisan groups, urban groups, rural groups. Now's when you get into the dicey part of redistricting.
So if you're in charge of redistricting and you say you want to, and you have an opposition party, if that opposition party district is going to be 51%, it might as well be 99%. Because you've lost that district, and you might as well pack in as many of your opposition as you can.
And that is one of the dynamics that happens. Absolutely.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Aretha is on the line. Aretha, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Doing great. You're on the air.
Thank you. Well, my comment has to do with the fact that the gerrymandering in Texas actually has created an environment where we have less representation because it's all based on socioeconomic demographic factors. And so you have these tiny little serpentine districts that run snake-like throughout the state. And people who have shared common interests, like everybody on the border who might need to be represented with a particular set of interests, or people along a river, people who have agricultural interests, everybody's representation has become just about the perception of our political desire, whether we're like extreme conservatives or, you know, it's not even about our shared interests as a district. It's really about these tropes of opinion.
Okay.
That just come down to whether you like abortion or not.
Okay. Aretha, let me get the professor to comment on that real quickly, Professor Keith. So shared common interest?
You've raised a very good point, and that is the question in redistricting of what is a community. We want to protect communities of interest. And in fact, one of the early standards was that we should have compact districts so that a community stayed together. But we have different definitions of community today.
All right. So we're going to get back into that because that is a great area, shared common interest and how that's being used with, for, and against districts in Texas. This is The Source on KSTX. We're talking about redistricting, voter ID, gerrymandering, and the Voting Rights Act in Texas. We invite your phone calls. Please call in 614-8980. I'm talking with Professor Gary Keith, the author or editor of Rotten Boroughs, Political Thickets, and Donnybrooks. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about redistricting, voter ID, gerrymandering, the vote, and the Voting Rights Act. And we're sitting down with author, editor Gary A. Keith. He has the book Rotten Boroughs, Political Thickets, and Legislative Donnybrooks, all about the history of redistricting in Texas. He's also a professor of government at the University of the Incarnate Word. Before we went to break, had a great phone call from Aretha. She talked about shared common interest. And there's just no way really to define what is shared common interest. And we see things like Austin being carved up into a way where it actually has no Democratic congressman, and so that they just split it up, even though you think a shared common interest would be a city would have a congressman.
This is the district that Lyndon Johnson represented, and as Austin grew, the district shrunk down just to be Austin. But today it is split into literally into five congressional districts. it's gone as a community of interest for congressional representation purposes. And so Reether raised a great point, and the question is, what do we want to be considered as a community? Our geographic community? Do we want South San Antonio to have a congressman? Or do you think of community more now in terms of your partisan identity? Do we want a Republican district or a Democratic district? Do you think in terms of race and ethnicity? We want a Hispanic district, a white district, a black district.
But there used to be some districts, it's when you look at them, you would see it as it was not really there. Like there was a district that kind of started up near Austin and went all the way down to the border. It's not like that anymore, but these fajita strip districts, they were calling them, were just like there was nothing really in common between the northern tip and the southern tip.
I think the court has abandoned this very idea of compact districts because there are so many issues in play in redistricting that they conflict with each other.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. And our number is 614-8980 if you want to jump in on this conversation. If we're not expressing a view that you want heard, then you got to pick up the phone and give us a call, 614-8980. Jose is on the line. Jose, you're on The Source.
Hi, how you doing? I'm enjoying this particular conversation. I'd like the speaker to comment on the fact that y'all have already observed that Texas was primarily a Democratic Party, but you did not comment on the fact that we were primarily a Dixiecrat Party, which is a very different entity than Democrats today. And the impact of what I'd like to hear is, okay, so what was the impact of voting rights in the 60s on the political parties in Texas? What moved us absolutely from a one-party state to a two-party state to a one-party state? Let me hear what the speaker has to say.
Okay, Jose, thank you for your call. Appreciate it. So he says that we were a Dixiecrat state. Is that what he said?
And Jose is absolutely right. So the Republicans were virtually non-existent. That didn't mean there was no competition here. The competition was inside the Democratic Party between the Dixiecrats and the National Democrats, known by different names over the years. But the Dixiecrats were often in power, not only in Texas, but across the South, Dixie. And they passed and maintained such laws as poll taxes, literacy tests, numerous ways to keep the electorate white. And they were very explicit about it. And so the Voting Rights Act that came along in 1965 from President Johnson and Congress was intended to stop the legal methods that the Southern legislatures were using to keep an all-white electorate. But it also had these political dynamics of changing the balance of power in the Democratic Party between Dixiecrats and the National Democrats, and also being a part of the rise then of the Republican Party. And then with the rise of the Republican Party, the Democratic Party changing into its modern version away from the Dixiecrats.
Well, in Texas, we saw the rise of the Raza Unida Party trying to create a political foothold for Latinos, Mexican Americans. And how did that eventually, merge with the Democrats?
In the 1970s, La Raza Unida was making the point that Chicanos, Hispanics, Mexican Americans are not heard in this party that is dominated by whites. So the modern Texas Democratic Party really is an amalgam of Hispanics and whites and blacks all in one party, very different from the old Dixiecrat Party. And the La Raza had a role in that.
So, but the way that the parties are now shaping up, you could look at the Democratic Party and say Raza Unida has basically taken over the Democratic Party in Texas. Because you look at the makeup of, the Democrats are in the Texas House now. They're mainly like Mexican Americans, right? Latinos.
Yes, but I wouldn't equate all of them with La Raza Unida or being of the same political mindset of La Raza. But you're right that it is a very different party, and there are...
Well, I'm not trying to... I'm missing a few facts here, but I thought it's not like a negative. Is it a negative?
Well, La Raza had viewpoints that some people agreed with, and not whether they were Hispanic or not, but they were very instrumental in energizing Hispanic voter participation and engagement in the political system in the Democratic Party, outside the Democratic Party. So they've had a role in the increased representation of Hispanics, but there have been a lot more than just. La Raza was essentially a 1970s dynamic.
Okay, well, this is interesting looking at that. Let's go back to the phones. Valerie is on the line. Valerie, you're on The Source.
Hi, I just wanted to talk about the new voter ID laws. I've heard every politician say that it's about preventing voter fraud, but there's very little evidence of that kind of actual voter fraud. But what I do not hear about people asking about is the cost associated with getting our so-called free IDs, which often mean getting a birth certificate, which costs money, or getting to a DMV where you might have to take a day off of work just to get there. I live in New Braunfels. I waited for 3 hours to get my license renewed, and there are stories all over Texas, even in major metropolitan areas, where we wait 2 and 3 hours at a time just to get our ID renewed, let alone submitting paperwork to get a brand new one. And there are some places in Texas where they don't even have a DMV, and they have to drive 2 or 3 counties over to a DMV that's only open on Tuesdays and Thursdays or something ridiculous like that. And that is disenfranchisement, in my opinion.
Okay. But
thank you. That's all I wanted to say.
All right, Valerie. So Valerie started off by asking about the you know, evidence of voter fraud. How bad is this? So this is a very particular type of voter fraud. It's got to be in-person impersonation voter fraud. That's what a voter ID would prevent.
Let me put this into a different context before we get down into the photo voter ID. I had a student last year in my constitutional law class from Germany. And as I started talking about voting rights in the United States and what we have to do to register to vote, I noticed that she was sitting there with her mouth open. She couldn't believe it. I actually just got back from spending 5 weeks in Germany as well. And the system in Germany is that you are registered to vote by the government. There's no issue of who can and can't, and you're registered to vote. It's a non-issue. Here it's a very big issue, and it's a very critical issue because, again, it all comes down into the question of who has a voice in the political discourse. So how do we frame the issue? Do you frame the issue by saying there is voter fraud and it is a legitimate concern of government to make sure that elections are honest? That's one framing. Another frame is there is very little evidence of voter fraud. Yes, there's fraud in anything that human beings do, but there's no rampant voter fraud, and so these efforts to have to go through all of these hoops that Valerie was describing to get identification have the effect of suppressing vote without affecting the question, the reality of the level of voter fraud.
So does it become a choice that we make in our society? What do we value more, trying to eliminate the very few illegal voting that goes on, the voter fraud, or and at the cost of disenfranchising 100,000 people or something?
Is it a choice? It's absolutely a choice, and one way that you can measure that is you look around at different states, and the states vary so much in what they allow, disallow, and in voter levels that we see in the different states. And the South has stood out for a long time in having lower voter turnout and in having more hurdles that people have to jump over before they can get exercise their right to vote.
Okay, one more question from the callers. Glenn, you're on the line. Glenn, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your taking my call, and I really appreciate hearing this discussion. I guess I really would. Valerie has said a lot of what I have to say. Let me just throw in the perspective that, quite honestly, I think it is just duplicitous and shameful what the Republican leadership is doing in this area. They hide behind a flimsy pretext of voter fraud, which is really not legitimate, and then just end up disenfranchising a large segment of the population that is likely to not vote for them. And it just seems so transparent and cynical to me what's the approach that they're taking. And I'll just throw out there, I mean, I'm the demographic that should be sympathetic to the Republicans. I'm a middle-aged white male. I'm an evangelical Christian. You'd think that I would be supporting the Republicans, and I'm ashamed of what's going on because I think it's anti-American.
All right, Glenn, thank you for your call. We appreciate that. We're going to continue the conversation into the next half hour, by the way. So for people who want to jump in on the conversation and add another point of view, we definitely want to hear from you. Glenn is saying that he sides that this is a calls it a flimsy excuse trying to prevent certain people from getting to the polls. And then he says that he feels that this is driving him from voting from a particular party. So you have a political consequence for this tactic.
In the book Rotten Boroughs, I have various authors, including two lawyers, one who represents Democrats and one who represents Republicans, and both of them describe the process as being one of raw political power battles, including party battles. And indeed, last week, Attorney General Abbott, in defending the actions of the state, was very explicit, saying our efforts to get Lloyd Doggett, Congressman Lloyd Doggett, were a partisan effort. They had nothing to do with race. So they are party battles. But race and ethnicity get caught up in that because we do have race and ethnic-based voting patterns.
Yeah, it's really hard to distinguish one from the other. You have, especially now, things are getting so stratified in politics along racial lines that it's tough to distinguish one from the other. And if you're trying to depress Democratic turnout, then you're in theory trying to depress Latino or minority voter turnout. So that's where you end up.
The constitutional question is whether there is that racial or ethnic intent and effect.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation, like I said, in the next half hour. We're going to be joined by State Representative Trey Martinez-Fisher, who has been on the front lines and has met with President Obama and Eric Holder on dealing with this. And we want to hear back from you guys. I know there's a lot of people out there who want to get your point of view across, so give us a call, 614-8980, 614-8980. But first, we're going to take a little break here for NPR News. This is The Source. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the second half of The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. It was in late July that San Antonio State Representative Trey Martinez-Fisher joined about two dozen other voting rights activists for a White House meeting with President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder. It was reported in that meeting that Obama and Holder made it clear they were going to fight against state efforts to limit voting and that Texas was going to be a key battleground. Joining me now to talk about that meeting and what has happened since and what might happen next is State Representative Trey Martinez-Fisher. Trey, are you there?
I am here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I appreciate that. So since the meeting, tell me about the meeting and what was the mood in that meeting?
Sure. I mean, let me tell you, it was history in the making. I think very rare to somebody to go to the West Wing of the White House and not only meet with the President of the United States, but the Attorney General of the United States, the Secretary of Labor, who ran the Civil Rights Division prior to becoming Secretary of Labor, all of the White House senior staff, senior officials, and then 20 national civil rights and voting rights experts from across the country. And we spent, about an hour, 30 minutes, 40 minutes of that time with the President talking about where do we go post Shelby County, the Supreme Court case that changed Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. Where do we go, and what does the Department of Justice do in the meanwhile until Congress gets the ability to enact a new formula, for Section 4? And so I have to tell you, there was a lot of discussion about Texas, and I think even the President himself referenced the situation in Texas. Attorney General Holder talked about making it very, very clear that there are still some very potent tools in the voting rights toolbox, both Section 2 and Section 3, and as far as he was concerned, he was going to use them when he felt like he needed to. The Texas case is clearly the case that is the most obvious case, and national leaders from across the country made reference to it because we have a voter ID case in Corpus Christi, and we have a redistricting case in San Antonio, and the common link is disinterested judges in Washington, D.C., on different occasions within
We're having a terrible phone connection there with Representative Martinez Fisher, but I think we kind of got the gist of what was happening. Back with Professor Gary A. Keith, he's the editor of the book Rotten Boroughs, Political Thickets, and Legislative Donnybrooks. And I do want to mention that you're going to have a book signing tomorrow at the Twig, right? What time?
7 o'clock.
7 p.m.? Okay. So talking about following up on what Trey was saying about this meeting, would you call that a historic meeting, that this was an important event?
It is. Here you had national voting rights leaders all at the White House. And in one sense, this is a federalism battle. In another sense, it's more of a constitutional battle. And both of those elements come in. And the Voting Rights Act is right there in the middle. And the representative is absolutely correct that the Voting Rights Act is so important and has been so critical since 1965. Shelby County versus Holder essentially gutted Section 5 of the Act, which has been used repeatedly against Southern
And that was
states.
The pre-clearance part of yes. the – and that allowed the Attorney General, the Justice Department, to stop states from doing things. They didn't have to – just proposing to change polling sites or limit early voting, anything at all, they had to run it through
Correct.
The Justice Department.
Or the court in D.C.
Right. And so, but now Martinez Fisher has said that Section 2 and Section 3 together equals Section 5, that they're able to use these other two sections to try and still get the same effect. But that has not been proven in court. This is still just theory.
This is breaking new ground. We've always had Section 5. And now that Section 5 is neutered, the question is whether the Attorney General will be able to use Section 2 and 3 together to the same effect. So what is the same effect? The Voting Rights Act essentially is there to enforce the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment established the right of citizens to vote equally and then says in Section 2 of Amendment 15, Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. The Supreme Court has now interpreted Section 5 as not being appropriate. Are Sections 2 and 3 both appropriate then and adequate to protect equal voting?
This is why when I talk to some of the state leaders about what's happening with voting rights, and they say that Eric Holder is way off base. He's ignoring the Supreme Court. He's coming up with his own rules. He's cowboying on voting rights. But they're both right because we don't know yet. None of this has not gone through what he's trying to do has not gone through a court challenge.
Texas will be once again in the foreground in litigation before the Supreme Court on voting rights, and we've been there many times.
I want to read an email that I got here. We're getting some emails from our listeners. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 614-8980. My liberal bona fides are perfectly intact, but I must depart from the herd here. I think the voter ID law is completely irrelevant. The people who haven't had the gumption to get some sort of qualified ID are almost certainly the people who aren't going to try to vote anyway. So he is challenging the whole notion that voter ID is going to be a significant part of a player in what the outcome is going to be on election day.
Well, let's take a couple of different scenarios. One is that there are people who do not have the photo ID that they might need, and perhaps they...
But he's saying that if you don't have a voter ID, probably you aren't going to vote anyway because you just can't get your act together.
Well, that's the case of the dog not barking. How would we ever know? It has to be a level playing field with everyone having equal access to it. If people don't have equal access, why should they even bother to try?
But also, I'm saying this, that if your name doesn't match exactly their voter ID and the voter rolls, then you could be turned away at the polls. And there is some question about how strict that enforcement will be, whether or not that will be enforced all across the board. Frequently, if your last name is De La Garza, De La Rosa, you may have run into a lot of problems over the years, or if you've had a maiden name, or if you're different, if you use, like I sometimes I go by Dave, I go by David, you never know what you're gonna be confronted with on these voting rolls. So how the voter ID could be used as a barrier to keep people from voting on that day. And if you don't check beforehand at the Secretary of State's office, they do have a web component that you can do that right now. But if you don't check before the end of voter registration, then you could find yourself not allowed to vote.
The Supreme Court has ruled in two or three cases from other states that the photo voter ID laws that those states have passed are legitimate and can be used. The question in the Texas case, and now North Carolina, South Carolina, is whether the restrictions, some of which you've just pointed out, go too far, that they will be so onerous that it becomes a vote suppression rather than an anti-vote fraud method.
And I did get an email about a day ago from some woman who said that she checked online and she found out the name that she'd been using, her own name, was very different than the name that they had on in the voting rolls, and she probably would have been turned away. We're going to continue this conversation. The number to call is 614-8980, 614-8980. We're talking about the Voting Rights Act in Texas and voter ID. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies, talking about voter ID, gerrymandering, redistricting, the Voting Rights Act in Texas. With me in the studio is Gary A. Keith. He is the editor of the book Rotten Boroughs, Political Thickets, and Legislative Donnybrooks. One of the things about in your book, when you talk about how when the Republicans used the courts to redistrict in Texas and fight for districts, because they were locked out and they had to turn to the courts to get to intervene in Texas, and they were using pretty much the same arguments that we're hearing today. And the Democrats, when they were in control, and they were the same objections that we hear today from the Republicans are being echoed from them, is that this is a violation of sovereignty, this is government overreach. So I just find that amusing.
What goes around comes around. There's a big battle across the nation, a big intellectual battle about whether we should get away from partisan redistricting bodies like legislatures and go to nonpartisan redistricting commissions. And a couple of states and some localities have tried this. You know, I mean, it's a serious question whether you really ever can take politics out of redistricting. But there are, Texas plays it to the hilt. It's raw partisan politics, whether it was the Democrats against the Republicans back then or vice versa now.
If you want to give us a call, the number is 614-8980, 614-8980. Or send me an email. That probably would be better because we are having a problem with our phone system. So you can email me with at thesource@tpr.org, thesource@tpr.org. Questions or comments, we'd love to get them on this topic. It was interesting that because the person who won the first Republican seat that was able to in that challenge, court challenge, was George Herbert Walker Bush.
Right. It started his career.
How did that work out?
Worked out great for him. It worked out great for the Republican Party. The redistricting. Republicans were right. Democrats had done everything they could to pack Republicans or to crack them apart so that they could not elect anyone. And as a result of abandoning the political thicket and with Baker versus Carr, courts getting involved in the battle, George Bush and others were able to go to the courts and say, hey, this is not fair. And the courts agreed and insisted that the legislature redistrict and do so in a way that created fair chances for people to win.
And this weekend when I was at the Democratic Party headquarters here in Bear County, and they had the state the party chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the national chair. She was there talking about battleground Texas and their drive to try and turn Texas blue, and it just seems like a very incredible, difficult challenge. The numbers are not there right now. But we see the demographics slowly getting to where they want to be. But even, you know, looking at some people have done studies and saying even 20 years out, they still may not have the numbers to be able to turn Texas blue. But the stakes are so high. If they can make Texas competitive, then I guess it would be a game of where who has the resources and where they can be directed.
This all comes down to, well, let me reframe the issue as a political scientist, in the context of democracy. What do you want in a democracy? The only way that a democracy can be genuine is if you have heightened participation. To get heightened participation, you need universal suffrage. You need high voter turnout. And we not only have low voter turnout in Texas, but we have a very disparate voting turnout across groups. And so you're right that with the varying turnout rates in the groups, that has political consequences. The question is whether we can have a neutral playing field.
All right. And an email received, the voter ID is a red herring. Also included in these laws are shortening early voting times, tighter voter registration requirements, etc. What do these other issues have to do with voter fraud? So Rick is trying to bring up some of these other issues that are brought into, that are basically countering what you talked about, trying to limit the pool of voters.
We're limiting the pool of voters in the sense that we have more and more requirements that people have got. For instance, you want to register people to vote, you've got to go down and you have to take a training before you can legally help people
become
register
deputized.
To vote. Be deputized. Absolutely. Again, I think the question is, do we want to do things that make it easier for people to vote from everywhere, or are we more concerned about voter fraud and that's where we put our efforts?
So I'm told we now have Representative Trey Martinez-Fisher back on the line. Are you there, Representative?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Sorry about the problems we're having with our phone system. We're hearing from our callers and our emailers saying that there can some people say that that anybody who wants to get an ID can get an ID. It's not that big of a deal. And if they don't get one, then they probably aren't going to vote anyway.
Well, you know, I agree with that. But let's not forget about the 795,000 Texans that are registered to vote in this state and do not have an ID. Let's not forget about the 80 Texas counties, or over one-third of the state, that does not have a DPS office in their county where these IDs are issued. And what are we going to do for them? And then let's not forget about the fact that it takes ID to get ID. And so when you go buy a copy of your birth certificate, that's $22, I believe, is what it costs. And some people say maybe that's a poll tax. The state of Texas did absolutely nothing to accommodate those folks. You could put a DPS officer in a van and do mobile registrations in these counties that are hard to reach. You could have them expand their office hours because DPS is only open Monday through Friday during business hours. There's only two or three locations in the city of San Antonio. We're the second largest, one of the second largest cities in the state. It's not easy to get this ID, and so we should be making these accommodations. But here I tell people all the time that they believe that the driver's license or that state-issued ID is the ID that tells you you are who you say you are, then why do you even need to register to vote? Why can't you just show up with your driver's license on the day of the election and say, here's my magic ID, it's bulletproof, give me a ballot?
So we have two conflicting philosophies. One of them is make it voting as easy as possible, make as many people allowed to vote as we can who are qualified, who are citizens, who get them to allow them to vote. And there's another philosophy is make it as restrictive as possible and make people earn that right to vote by getting the proper paperwork and going through a registration system and making sure that their name matches up with the system and everything else.
Well, no, that's entirely true. And I think it when you start getting these winners and losers before there's even an election, you have redistricting on the one hand where we are now telling people what we want these districts to look like. And then if that wasn't enough, then we're going to decide who is going to be eligible to vote in that particular election. And I think that we're looking at this the wrong way. We should be looking to expand the franchise, not to restrict the franchise.
But all this is going to go through the courts. And we were talking earlier about what Eric Holder is trying to do has not really been tested yet. This is still legal theory, right?
Well, Section 3 cases have been tried. And in fact, the Maryland people with the Legal Defense Fund told everybody at the White House that she recalls one of the very first cases she worked on was a Section 3 case. One of the most prolific voting rights lawyers who has experience in Section 3 is Pamela Carlin, who runs the Stanford Supreme Court Clinic. Pamela Carlin is part of our the Mexican American Legislative Caucus. She's part of our legal team. We believe that this is not, this is sort of rare in a sense that Section 5 did everything. But in the absence of Section 5, because of Section 4 that is no longer applicable, Section 3 will jump to the front, as well as I think you'll see more aggressive litigation with respect to Section 2 and the ability to seek injunctive relief to sort of stop these things. That's the problem with Section 2 is it looks backwards. Section 5 sort of stopped things from occurring until they were able to become pre-cleared. I think you're going to see Section 2 operate more aggressively. And I sort of take the view, and I mean it in a very simplistic way, but if you add Section 3 to Section 2, that'll give you Section 5. It's just going to be a little bit harder to get there, but there is a way.
Now, according to Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott, candidate for governor, voter IDs have nothing to do with race. They are free to anyone who needs one. Eric Holder's outrageous claim that voter ID is a racist plot to disenfranchise minority voters is gutter politics and is offensive to the overwhelming majority of Texans of all races who support this ballot integrity measure.
Well, I don't deny that Greg Abbott said that, but it's pretty very clear to me that Greg Abbott did not read the opinion from the district court for the District of Columbia. That otherwise, they said that ID all of it, appears in the state of Texas to follow both race and economics, and racial minorities and poor people were disproportionately impacted. The state of Texas did nothing to offset that. And quite frankly, while it's offensive to Greg Abbott, I think it's offensive to Texans, particularly the 795,000 of them that were voting just fine. Remember all of this. Of all of the allegations and all the rumor and fear-mongering about in-person voter impersonation, it doesn't really happen in the state of Texas. There's been, I believe, one successful case where there has been a plea bargain or conviction, or maybe even two. That's out of 13 million votes cast after the 2008-2010 election. Of the voter fraud exists either happens at the poll through poll worker activity and electioneering, or it happens with the use of mail ballots. And voter ID, nothing for that. So if Greg Abbott really wants to do something about voter fraud in the state of Texas, maybe he should get serious about mail ballots and stop harassing and putting pressure on people who want to vote by making them have some ID as if that's going to be the sacred document that's going to allow someone to vote, when we know that for elections several decades going back, just walking to the poll in your neighborhood and being recognized by the election judge was about enough you needed to do to get a ballot in America.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of issues. People are concerned about name matching, like their driver's license matching the voter rolls. And if they don't match precisely, then they may not be allowed to vote.
I think that is a real concern. And then let's look at what standards are we going to deploy across the state. There are 254 counties in the state of Texas. And what standards are going to be set to allow the discretion at the election, at the election judge level, to say, okay, this person's name on
okay.
their driver's license.
Trey Martinez-Fisher, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. We've been talking with Gary Keith, the author of Rotten Boroughs, Political Thickets, and Legislative Donnybrooks, having his book signing at the Twig tomorrow. This is The Source.